And our special guest tonight, Neil Slade. His website, Neil Slade, N-E-I-L, Slade.com, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. He has written a book called The Frontal Lobes Supercharge, in a tremendous DVD movie, An Amazing Brain Adventure. And I'll give you a phone number here, too. It's toll-free, 1-800-331-7589, if you want to learn more about the brain. Back in a moment. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Neil Slade, our guest. Neil, let's get back to the gut and what that has to do with being another brain, if you would.
No, I'm sorry. What did you
do? We're talking about the gut and the extra brain.
Oh, yes,
the stomach.
Yes. Well, you know, what's interesting is that when we found that medications that affect brain processes also seem to have an effect on our digestive system. And the reason now that we understand that is because we have the same types of cells in our abdomen and in our digestive system. So it's one way of, again, showing the similarity between the neural network in our gut and the neural network in our brain. When we talk about activating more brain potential, it's very important to emphasize the fact that more brain doesn't mean more verbalization. It doesn't mean that you're able to memorize more numbers or facts. You know, 80 to 85% of the information that you take in to your brain comes in visually, for starters.
Sure.
Okay? Most of our brain is, if we look at the construction of the way that the brain is set up, most of it deals with nonverbal information, with spatial information. When we talk about gut instincts, when we talk about intuitions, when we talk about things like paranormal abilities, we're talking about things that are beyond language, that are on a whole different level than language.
When you look at men and women, a brain's a brain is a brain, right? Or is there a difference?
Well, there are differences between, you know, I mean, the question is who's smarter? I mean, that's the ultimate question. Who's smarter, men or women?
Right? You're going to answer that?
Sure, I can. I would say, now, first of all, you've got to define intelligence, okay? But one of the things that we measured at the brain lab was the ability for people to have this peak experience phenomenon.
Now, what's that?
It's historically, it's got a million different names. Every religion's got a name for it. Scientists have a name for it. But we will just call it peak experience. You know, Kensho, Moksha, born again, medicine vision. It's this rapturous feeling that you're one with the universe, that you're out of time and space. You know, people report this in near-death experiences, mm-hmm. right? When they've left their body.
Is this like being in a meditative trance or anything like
well,
that?
Well, a trance would sort of imply that you're numb to the world. This is kind of the opposite. This is having an enhanced, psychedelic almost, perception of the universe and the environment, and seeing how everything's connected. So at the brain lab, we came up with our own name. We called it frontal lobes transcendence, right? Where you've risen above, you've transcended all of your problems, and you've transcended all of the minutiae of daily life, and you see the cosmic picture, okay? So the question was, back to our original question, who's more intelligent, men or women? Well, as it turns out, of the hundreds of people who went through the brain lab and learned basic brain self-control, and twice as many women had this experience as men.
Twice as many. That's interesting.
Now, there's a reason. We believe there's a reason for that. And I'll tell you what it is.
Okay.
This goes back to why you need to know how the human brain is constructed, right? Because if you understand that, then you'll have a signpost pointing you towards frontal lobe's transcendence and this cosmic understanding of the universe.
So there's a difference here.
There's a difference. Men, think about how men behave and what their role in culture and society is. Okay, I won't tell you just yet. Now, think about, let's see if you and your listeners get this. Think about the role of women. What is the significant difference between the role of women and the role of men behaviorally?
Behaviorally?
Yeah. Look at the family structure.
Well, I would say that the woman generally runs the home. Whether this is today or not, I'm just talking from behaviorally.
Okay.
She raises the child generally.
You just hit one of them, yep.
Well,
that's a big one right
there.
And what do the men do? Let's go back to caveman time.
Well, they generally get the food.
How do they get the food? They go out and they...
work.
They work or they hunt.
They hunt.
They go out and they kill. Right? Now, what part of your brain do you have to use to go out and kill the woolly mammoth?
That's your reptoid.
Right. Right?
Okay.
Are you concerned with the welfare of the young ones at home while you're out killing the woolly mammoth?
Probably not.
Okay. You're competing with the woolly mammoth, right? Okay. What if there are some other Neanderthals in your territory? Are you going to say, oh, well, you were here first, so it's... No, men culturally are conditioned to play football and hockey and competitive sports. They're culturally conditioned to go out and hunt and compete in the workplace and to climb the ladder. They are functioning out of this more reptilian type of core. Now, contrast that with women, whose job it is to stay home and, just like you said, raise the kid. Now, you know, roles are not hard and set, but we're talking about...
You're talking about how it was...
We're talking about more generalized, culturally conditioned behaviors. And you can see this, you know, not just in the United States, but if you go all throughout the world, there's a tendency of this type of behavior. The women stay home and raise the young, so they're functioning out of the second layer in that layer cake.
Well, and you can look at the animal world, and that's a perfect example of what you're saying.
Well, it's even more dramatic in the animal
world. Yes, it is.
Although there are, again, exceptions. If you look at a pride of lions, the male sleeps in the shade of the tree, and mostly it's the lionesses who go out and do the hunting. So
nothing wrong with that.
There's nothing wrong with that. So, you know, there's always exceptions. But in general, you know, in our culture and our society, you know, the men are functioning out of the reptilian part of the brain, the competitive part of the brain, where the women are in the PTA and they're raising the kids.
Is that by conditioning or is that biologically?
Well, you know, I mean, this obviously goes back thousands of years to the emergence of the patriarchal society, as opposed to, you know, societies where women played a more dominant role. Now, we're seeing a reversal of roles in these days, and we may see a change, you know, as roles become more homogenous in our society, as women take on some of the roles that men take, and vice versa. We may, if we were to continue to study the occurrence of this frontal lobe's cosmic transcendence experience, we may see a balancing of that.
When you look at the brain, there are things that we did as children that we seem to grasp quicker than we do as an adult. Yet we're supposed to be smarter as we get older. I'm not necessarily, I don't think that's true. How come?
Well, I think what you're saying about children learning faster, this is an undisputed fact that children learn new information faster than adults.
Oh, they could learn video games, computers, yeah, faster than an adult ever could.
Yes, but the adult brain and the senior brain and the teenage brain, they all operate differently. They're not all operating in the same way. Now, what is interesting is that I just this evening I read of a research experiment where they gave teens and elderly people two kinds of tests. They gave a verbal test, and then they gave a spatial test. And then they scanned the brains of the teens and of the old people. And as it turned out, both groups did equivalently well in the problem-solving tasks. The old people did just as well in solving the problems as the young people.
Okay.
But the brain scan showed that they used their brains in different ways, which is kind of interesting. The young person used more of the back part of the brain, the occipital lobes, which processes visual information.
And this is overall, right?
Excuse me?
Overall, the young children use that part of the brain,
yes,
right?
And that's because their brains are physically different from older people. But they use the midbrain, the limbic system, and they use the occipital lobes, which they use those parts of their brain to problem solve. Whereas the older people used their memory centers, and they used their hippocampus. They used parts of the brain that were more memory intensive. How they learn is different, okay?
Why? But why the difference?
Well, for example, I'll give you one example why young people and old people use their brains differently. First of all, as you grow older, you establish all kinds of memory neural networks. So it makes sense to use those from experience, for example. Whereas young people don't have a backlog of data memory to draw upon, they have to process information in a different way. More importantly, a young person's brain is developing all the way through to their early 20s. The frontal lobes, which is, again is this executive part of the brain, the very front part of the brain, you don't even have all your frontal lobes until you're 21 or 22. So if you were to depend on those, you would be quite shortchanged. And one of the things that's very interesting is that now we understand why teenagers, for example, can be so impulsive. How teens may not see cause and effect of their actions and over a long period of time. Well, they just don't have the neural networks physically set up to do that.
All right, let me give you an example, and you tell me what went wrong here then. In Missouri, there's a winery in an area called Augusta. Gorgeous area. People go out there in the spring and the fall. You know, you just go out there and sip some wine and just take it easy. Well, lately, people have been going out there, Neil, sipping a little bit too much wine. So what the police departments out there have decided to do is to set up a few little DUI stops along the way, or they've assigned a number of officers to look for swerving cars. And I was reading a report by an officer just last week, and he said, you know what? We thought we would be stopping more younger people coming back from these wineries overindulging in drinking. And he said, that's not the case. He said, it's strange, but we're stopping more adults. They are drinking more than the younger kids. Now, you would think the younger, the adult would know better, right? He'd have more of those neurons out there that say, you don't drink and drive. But according to this police officer, that's not happening out there. And I'm just wondering why.
Well, I don't know. You know, you can't say that all irresponsible behavior comes from young people.
Right.
And, you know, what's the saying? You know, old people start wars and young people fight them, you know. So I don't know if you can make a general statement about irresponsible behavior, but I think you can say a statement about the nature of behavior and how it's different from, in general, a adolescent or teen, how they approach certain problems and behaviors versus adults. Now, it sounds like these adults who are being stopped have not yet grown up out of their child adolescent brain, and they haven't made the neural connections to
or maybe the brain cells don't grow back in their case.
I don't know.
Emotion's another part of the factor, Neil. There are some people who just can't handle crises. They can't handle emotion. They can't handle stress. Other people, it's like water off their back. I mean, it's just no big deal. They go on with their lives. They approach their problems. They move on. Other people can't handle it. Why? Why the difference?
Well, I would say there's a couple of factors. One factor, of course, is body-brain chemistry. Okay, if it depends, your brain chemistry can have a very, very big effect on how you react to stress. A good example would be drug use, for example. Okay, an extreme case would be someone who's ingested PCP or amphetamines, where their brain chemistry is greatly altered. And their reactions to certain stressful conditions can be fatal, can be deadly. They absolutely will go bonkers just because of the chemistry that's happening in their brain. If you have nutrients that are missing dietarily in your, in your diet, if you are insufficient in some nutrients, that can make you much more susceptible to negative effects of stress. Okay? So just body and brain chemistry can make a difference.
But, you know, some people need, let's say, pharmaceutical prescriptions to alter their moods.
Yeah.
Other people wouldn't even touch it. Does that mean there's something physically wrong with their brain? The connections are screwed up?
Well, absolutely. If a pharmaceutical works in calming a person down, or in, you know, I mean, there's a
changing their mood.
There's a tie between brain chemistry and behavior. Now, the other thing I was going to mention was brain chemistry can have an effect, but brain chemistry is also dependent upon our behavior and how we have learned to handle stress and situation. They're linked. They're in some ways one and the same thing.
Yeah.
As you grow up, you know, as an infant, you're being taught life lessons by your parents. You learn from your parents how to react to situations. You're learning how to problem solve situations. You learn this from your parents. You learn it from your teachers. You learn it from your peer group. And as you grow older, you apply these skills to problem solve or to accomplish those tasks that you've chosen in this life to accomplish. Now, if you have a very high failure rate, if you haven't learned the tools, then you're going to be frustrated and you're going to be subject to a lot of stress.
Stay with us. Neil Slade, our guest. We're going to talk about ESP and one of his favorite words, the amygdala, and get ready for some of those exercises because he's going to tickle your amygdala. I kid you not. I'll be right back. Well, on our next Coast to Coast program, our guest is Mary Ann. She's called the Irma Bombeck of Ghostbusters, the happy ghost chaser. We're going to talk a little bit about the spirits. That'll be on our next Coast to Coast program. But when we come right back, it's Neil Slade and the amygdala on Coast to Coast AM. Neil, let's talk a little bit about ESP before we get into the amygdala and some of those exercises.
Sure.
Some people are extremely intuitive. They've got the ability to sense things. They've got this instinct in them. I think it's the brain. I think it has a lot to do with how they have tuned themselves up. Do you find it to be more biological or supernatural?
Well, what we found at the brain lab and was that people could access these types of paranormal occurrences, and we're talking about precognition and telepathy and even telekinesis and ESP and clairvoyance and clairaudience, if they were able to click out of their reptile brain and forward into their frontal lobes, the most advanced cooperative part of the brain, all that paranormal stuff would just happen spontaneously. And it wasn't so much a matter of willing the paranormal stuff to happen. It was simply almost the paranormal types of occurrences were spontaneous, natural expressions of their advanced brain processes. Okay? It was just a matter of clicking out of that primitive center of the brain and letting the energy go forward. And one of the things that I try to do is come up with very simple methods of kind of amplifying, you know, those kinds of natural instincts, those natural ESP types of abilities mm-hmm. in a person. Now, I wanted to play something for you, and I'll give you a demonstration of kind of how we can do it. Tell me if you can identify this sound. Okay. Now, do you know what that was?
Oh, the where it was from, or the instrument they used?
No. What did you just hear the sound of?
Some like old cartoon or something like that.
Well, I'll tell you what it was, and this is something I picked up at a secondhand shop. This is an old gramophone.
Right.
Right. It's a mechanical device that doesn't use any electricity.
You wind it up.
You wind it up, and what it does is it amplifies almost microscopic grooves on a record.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let's think about what's happening here. We have a flat platter, okay? And all the information is embedded in little wavy lines that are a fraction of a millimeter across in grooves, right? And what you do is you put a little tiny needle that fits in the groove, right? And the needle vibrates. And that needle is attached to a little bigger piece of metal, which then attaches to a diaphragm, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's about an inch in diameter. Now, the diaphragm sits upright against a little tube that's about a half an inch diameter. So we've gone now from a fraction of a millimeter to a fraction of an inch to something that's about an inch in diameter. And then it goes into a tube that's like that enlarges into a horn, right? And it's a funnel, and it gets bigger and bigger until it finally expands out to this big horn, right? We all know what a gramophone looks
yeah.
like, right? So
that's what the Buster Brown dog buys.
That's right. And what's so very interesting is if you look at you can pick up a record. There's no sound there, right? It's just wavy lines embedded in a piece of plastic, right? But through this kind of gradual physical amplification, it transfers from one piece of material to another that gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and you can have this big sound, okay? Okay. Now, one thing that you can use, if you think about the brain, okay, the brain is a collection of very small microscopic particles that are interacting, the neurochemical reactions between one neuron to the next.
Right.
Okay. And we're talking about something that's existing on a level that you really can't see. You've got to look at it with a microscope. Well, those neurons are in turn connected to pieces of muscle, okay? If you you start from the inside of the brain and then you go to the outside of the brain, and then it goes down your spinal cord, right? Okay, so the brain bone is connected to the neck bone, right? And the neck bone is connected to the shoulder bone.
How true.
Right? And the shoulder bone is connected to the arm bone, right? And we go from connections that exist on a very microscopic level to a bigger muscle tissues, to blood tissues, to bones, and we keep expanding, right? And we come to our hand. Well, in your hand, you can hold a very simple device, which many people know as a pendulum, right?
All right.
Okay. Now, you can make a pendulum out of a needle and thread. It doesn't have to be anything fancy that you have to spend money on. You could use a piece of string and a washer, right?
Anything with a little weight at the bottom.
Anything with a little weight. Now, I've got a pendulum in my hand right now, and I'm thinking about, now, if I hold this pendulum, okay, and I just hold my arm steady, well, it's the nerve impulses that begin in the brain slowly make their way through all these connections, kind of like in the same way the gramophone started out with just a little tiny microscopic wavy line that's connected to one thing, and it gets bigger and bigger and bigger until we get this big sound, and some we hear something happening. We have an expression through this physical amplification of what was a tiny wavy line into something musical, something we can hear, something we can see and share with other people. Well, if you hold your pendulum, okay, even if you try to hold your arm steady, that pendulum is going to start swinging.
As a matter of fact, some people use that as a lie detector test.
That's right.
Yep.
That's right. And as it turns out, a woman who actually predicted a month ago that I would be a guest on your show used a pendulum.
Really?
To predict this. She said, now I hadn't talked to you in about 2 years,
that's
George,
true.
Right?
That is true.
Out of the blue, this woman said, oh, you know, Neil, you're going to be on the Coast to Coast show in a month. I said, oh, really? Well, that's a surprise to me.
Was that my producer, Lisa?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, her name is Trudy Koch, and she, I could tell you a lot of her history, but she is one of these. She's been a member of our Brain Adventure list group for many years, and she understands the brain, but she is kind of a natural psychic, one of the types that you were talking about. But she's utilized all the brain information to amplify her skills, and she shared with me the information about the pendulum recently.
That's interesting.
So I said to Trudy, well, you know, how can we use the pendulum to help people click their amygdala forward and move their frontal lobes into action? Okay. Now, this is very interesting because it's a really good analogy between the gramophone and the pendulum, okay? And I'll tell you
sure.
What this is. She said, okay, take your pendulum, and instead of waiting for the pendulum to swing, deliberately swing the pendulum in a clockwise motion and say, amygdala, click forward, okay? And by saying amygdala, click forward, what we're trying to, the amygdala is kind of like a light switch inside the middle of your brain.
It's something physical. It's there.
It's a physical. We like to call it the master brain click switch because what it does, it either clicks on this reptilian fight or flight reaction, or it allows the most advanced part of your brain to compute advanced brain processing.
And what's it look like again, Neil?
It looks like a walnut, actually. It's
okay.
If we get the word almond, amygdala.
It's about that size too?
Yeah, it's about the size of the tip of your thumb, and it looks like a little wrinkly almond portion. And if you go to my website, we actually have a picture of a real amygdala in a cross section of a brain now. If people take the link from your page,
does it ever malfunction?
Oh, yes.
Oh, it does.
Oh, yeah, sure. Okay. Sure. People who fly into we've seen damaged brains with amygdalas that are damaged, and people lose control of their emotions. people who are not able to exercise any type of control over their emotions can have damaged amygdalas.
Is this clicking, first of all, natural, back and forth, this switch clicking of the amygdala?
Yes.
It is. So what you're saying is you could control the clicking.
Absolutely. You can consciously control the amygdala so that you click it backwards when you want to be
that
in
is
reptile
interesting.
Brain.
So like when you say, I'm lifting my left hand and I'm waving it and my fingers all move, you're saying we can train ourselves to do the same thing with the amygdala?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. But you got to know how the brain is connected. You see, you've got to be able to know when you're clicked forward.
And what purpose it would, you know, if you click it, why are you clicking it?
That's right. Well, it interests the amygdala sits right in the middle of the limbic system, the emotional mammal part of the brain. So it's very interesting. It indicates through your emotion tells you which part, which way your amygdala is clicking. Okay? Now think about times when you're very...
And it clicks two ways, I guess, right?
Well, it clicks, it's more like the thermostat. It's more like a rheostat.
Okay.
There's
infinite number of ways.
Right.
Okay.
You can be clicked backwards just a little bit into defensive behavior, right?
Right, or a lot.
Or you can be clicked, you know, if you're, let's say, in a battle, you'll be all the way clicked
sure.
backwards.
Okay.
Now think about when you are extremely competitive, when you're extremely worried about survival, okay? When you're engaged in reptilian types of activities, you tend to experience negative emotions because that's the nature of competitive consciousness, right? We're not talking about a friendly baseball game, okay? We're talking about somebody who's, you know, trying to kill you, okay? That would be an extreme example of being clicked all the way backwards.
Is that why sometimes, though, some people going into a tense situation are cool, calm, and collected? Because somehow they've had an ability, maybe they didn't even know they were doing this, but they've clicked their amygdala, and whatever it's supposed to work is working for them.
That's right. The best reptile is the one who's got a lot of frontal lobes turned on at the same time.
Exactly.
Right? That's a person who's using their whole brain. You know, they're smart enough not to walk in front of a Mack truck, okay? But, you know, I mean, the best football player is the one who can really plan ahead, who's got the best strategy.
And he's ready for anything. Yeah.
Just brute force is not going to, is only going to work for a few seconds.
Right. I agree.
If you're a human brain, you got to use your whole brain. But if you're clicked backwards, you know, educators call it downshifting. When you're clicked backwards into fear and competition, your success goes down. If we were to measure success and achievement, the more you're clicked backwards into this competitive reptilian types of me consciousness, the less successful you are.
When you first wake up, where's your amygdala clicked?
That's a very interesting question. Think about when you're in sleep. We were talking before about the, you know, what sleep is for,
mm-hmm.
right? Okay. When you get into bed at night and you're relaxed and you fall asleep, can you fall asleep when you're really angry
and thinking?
Or if you're really fearful?
No, you can't do that.
You can't do it.
When you
you're
toss,
sleeping,
you turn.
You have to click forward into a cooperative. In a state of mind where you feel safe, okay? Your defense system is down,
all right.
Okay? You've laid yourself, you've actually taken off all your mental and body armor. You've taken the suit of armor off, all the defensive behaviors and process, they're all shut down, okay? You've clicked forward. Now, when you wake up in the morning, all those defenses are still on hold, you know? I mean, unless you pop out of bed and you've got your fist up ready to fight.
You're ready to roll, yeah.
You're ready to roll. So what's really interesting is that that short period of time between dream state, okay,
mm-hmm.
where your defenses are down, you've clicked forward. You're open to all this receptive types of information to come in. We call this morning pre-consciousness. And that's when your ESP is really at its height, because the thing that blocks the ESP and the paranormal is the reptilian is having an overactive reptilian brain.
Too much, then. Too much. Okay.
Think about, again, when we think about reptiles, they're not social, right?
Right.
Well, what is ESP? ESP is communicating with the universe.
Sure.
It's communicating with everybody. So doesn't that make sense that if you're in your reptilian mode, your ESP is going to be completely shut down?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So what you can do is consciously direct your brain functions away from these reptilian me, fight or flight survival.
So what are you thinking? Move the amygdala forward, backward, click yes?
Lots of ways to do it, okay? Just a simple visualization that you've got two little almonds in your head, okay? And we've talked about this all the time. You can visualize that you're tickling those almonds with a feather. And just that mere visualization makes that amygdala click forward to visualize.
Automatically.
To visualize anything with your abstract mind requires frontal lobes processes, right? It's kind of interesting.
Right. How long does it stay clicked in?
It depends on that cultural conditioning and what you've learned from your parents, teachers, and people.
How do you know if it has clicked out?
Your emotional feedback. Follow? Because when you're clicked forward into love, cooperation, imagination,
intuitiveness,
right?
play,
you even if you only do it at the level of mammal brain function, okay? We talked about mammals play, right? Reptiles don't play. Mammals experience pleasure. Reptiles they don't experience emotion.
So what I have experienced, Neil, and I've talked about this on the show, and we haven't put a biological finger to it, that there seems to be so much bitterness and hatred going on this planet lately.
Yeah.
In tension. My thought then is that most of these people's amygdalas haven't clicked in yet. Is that possible?
Oh, it's not possible. I mean, it's a certainty. It's a certainty. So let's go back to how do you make it click forward? Well, you start with yourself, and then it's contagious. Well, if your amygdala is clicked forward, it's like a smile, right? If you smile at somebody, they can almost not help themselves and smile back at you.
Well, I tell you what, when we come back at the top of the hour, we'll talk more about the amygdala, how people can click it. And then also we'll take phone calls for the rest of the hour with our guest, Neil Slade. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.